Hi everyone, sorry I can't be with you tonight. Ali and I are in Leeds for a conference of the Anglican Mission in England, Church Leaders Conference, Training Conference. So we'll be here until Saturday afternoon. So again, really sorry I'm not with you. So we're trying this again. I've just having recorded some teaching, and we're continuing our series in looking at some of the stories Jesus told, maybe just to help us try and identify, work out what kind of church we're going to be, what's going to be important for our identity. So tonight we're looking at Luke chapter 19, verses 11 to 27, and I hope that someone has read that for us, and I'm going to try and look at that story. It's that great story of the parable of the 10 minas, or minas, where the master distributes his gifts and to his servants, and then comes back looking to see what they've done with it. So we're going to think a little bit about that tonight. What might that mean for us as servants of the master? I don't know about you. I know it's, you know, I joke about only working one day a week, and would that that were true, but it's not. But like most people, I struggle with Monday mornings, just getting going again. I mean, my week begins with Sunday, but Monday morning can be really difficult for people, can't it? And all of us struggle with that. There's that great song from the 1980s, The Boomtown Rats. I hope you're familiar with that song. It's I Don't Like Mondays, it's called. And lots of us don't like Mondays for all sorts of reasons. And when you think about it, there's quite a lot of evidence to suggest that Mondays medically are a really difficult day. So more heart attacks happen on a Monday than on any other day of the week. Strokes, it's the same. And strokes are a result of high blood pressure, people being stressed out by that. People in the workplace, on a Monday, your stomach acidity can be higher because you're under stress and under pressure, and your digestive system takes pressure, and that can lead to more ulcers and more stress from that. And actually, there's some research which suggests that people are twice as likely to commit suicide on a Monday as any other day of the week. So Mondays are not great. And I wonder if that's to do with our workplace being work. And for some people, work can be really depressing. So you add in the medical stuff, and then you have the kind of drudgery of work. Some people's work is just repetitive. I once had a job that was on a production line, a whiskey bottling production line, and it consisted of filling and emptying boxes to put bottles of whiskey in and out of boxes. That was all I did every day. Maybe broken up with moving a whole pallet of boxes to the warehouse with a trolley. And that was it. I've also had jobs stacking shelves in supermarkets, and lots of people, that's their work life. You know, they are not going to do anything other than that for the whole of their life. And that can be stressful, and it can be people can feel that they're not worth very much. But of course, every job is really significant. And then others at the other extreme, maybe people are workaholics. The expectations are that people work under are really, really high. I had a friend who worked for the Royal Mail, Parcel Force. In fact, he worked for Parcel Force, and he travelled in from Stansted to London every day, 5 days, 6 days a week sometime. And he had to be there early enough for his first boss. He had two bosses above him that he worked for. He had to be there early enough for his first boss, who came in at 7 o'clock in the morning. And then his second boss came in sort of more around lunchtime and worked into the early evening. So effectively, this guy had to be there for at least 12 hours a day, 5 or 6 days a week. And that was quite stressful. And then we've got the problem of people being workaholics. They just don't know how to take time off. They don't know how to switch off. They don't know how to rest. And all of these things are real problems for people. And even if your employer is a good employer, And there's things like trying to give you a comfortable space to work in, and nice lighting, nice furniture, background music to comfort you, and so on. Even in that circumstance, it doesn't necessarily take away the stress. It's a good attempt, but it doesn't necessarily make it any less stressful. And then you've got the problem of people just being lazy. I've talked to various people who have taken on new employees, younger people recently, who basically don't really want to work, or they work the bare minimum. You know, they'll work the hours and that will be it. And, you know, there was a time when people worked and worked and worked, you know, because that's what you did in order to fulfill what needed to be done. But there might be another problem now where people are a little bit lazy, not willing to kind of put in the effort and the work, partly because they don't take any pride in what they do, and there's a sense of entitlement. And not everybody is like that, but maybe it's a kind of feature of our culture and our society. And then what about people who lose their jobs, who are made redundant, can't find work, or even when you come to the end of your working life and you retire? That can be really stressful, and it can affect your health as well. That, you know, what are you going to do? Where do you take your importance from? Where do you take your sense of purpose and belonging from when you no longer have work, either through no fault of your own because it's time to retire and step back? That can create great stress. And underneath all of that, I wonder if the biggest problem attached to that is people just don't have a sense of hope or a sense of meaning. They don't derive that from working and serving. And I just wonder whether that would be a difficulty. And our work has become something that is... It can be worthless and meaningless. Watched a film recently about the potato famine in Ireland in the 1840s, and you know, hundreds of thousands of people were suffering and dying, and leaving the country, emigrating, and the British government decided that the way to kind of alleviate the suffering was to create jobs. And so they created jobs building roads, but roads that weren't necessary, roads that led nowhere. Literally, the road to nowhere. That's what they did. And, you know, work can sometimes feel like that. It's meaningless and it doesn't have any kind of function. And actually, rather than alleviating people's sense of meaningless, it can create more sense of meaningless. So, you know, that's a huge, huge issue. And I wonder, you know, sometimes we have to think very carefully, what does the Bible have to say about meaning and service and our work and so on? Well, this parable from Luke chapter 19 kind of fills that in for us a little bit. You know, as Christians, as followers of Jesus, we should be people who are full of hope and full of anticipation. It should be a feature of our walk with the Lord, that we are full of hope and we are full of anticipation for what he has in store for us. And hope is it's an exciting thing, isn't it? It's like, you know, those of us, you know, when we're adults, we kind of anticipate having time off, having holiday. And, you know, we've just, last week we had a few days off and we realised that we'd not taken some time off since September last year, not proper time off. So we needed a few days away. And I was so excited about this, you know, the idea of having a few days just together. We get excited by that. You know, you imagine children at Christmas time and their sense of anticipation and about Santa Claus coming to visit. Now, we need that in our lives, don't we? We need a sense of hope and anticipation about what might be around the corner. And it's really important to people that they have that. I wonder what you look forward to. You know, what gives you that sense of anticipation? Maybe it's seeing grandchildren or family coming to visit. It's a good thing to have that hope and that anticipation. So this story that Jesus told is kind of about that. It's kind of about giving people hope and helping people anticipate for the future. So let's look at it a little bit and see if it might help us. So it does tell us that work has purpose and can give us meaning. So let's look at it. You might want to open your Bible up and have it before you. So turn with me to Luke chapter 19. And I'm going to try and take us through it as quickly as I can. And hopefully we'll get things from it that will be helpful. So we begin at verse 11. We see that sense of anticipation that the people of the time had. While they were listening to this, he went on to tell them a parable because he was near Jerusalem and the people thought that the kingdom of God was going to appear at once. So they're near Jerusalem, they're about 20 miles from Jerusalem in a place called Jericho, which we all know of, where Joshua kind of walked around the walls and the walls came tumbling down. We know that from this story, but Jesus on his way to Jerusalem. And the background of this is people are anticipating that Jesus might turn out to be the Messiah, who's one who's going to show the Romans up and bring them down and bring about a kind of new beginning for the nation. And people are really anticipating that. And Jesus has faced this again and again, and here he has it again, and he's trying to tell them a story, not this time to the Pharisees or to the rest of the people. He's trying to tell his own disciples. His own disciples, some of them, had this same kind of anticipation that that's what was going to happen. The kingdom is at hand. We're going to see the kingdom coming about. And Jesus tried to calm them down. He's trying to say to them, look, we're not going to have political triumph here. In fact, quite the opposite. It's going to end with me dying. And so he tells them this parable to try and help them understand that that's what's going to happen. And in verse 12, he begins by saying, a man of noble birth went to a distant country to have himself appointed king and then to return. And you see what he's saying there? He's describing himself in this. And he's saying the king is going to go away and one day he will return. The king's going to go away, but one day he's going to come back. And I think in this instance, this story, he's talking about himself. The king is going away, but he's going to come back. I'm leaving, but I will be back, he says. And then verse 13 goes on, in the meantime, so he called 10 of his servants and gave them 10 minas, which might have been, scholars seem to think it might have been about £50,000 worth of money, something like that. Quite a substantial sum that he's giving to people. And he says in verse 13, put this money to work until I come back. Put this money to work until I come back. In other words, do the most you can to the best of your ability. Invest in the kingdom by working as hard as you can. This is the instruction of the Lord. I'm going to go, but I'm giving you resources. Please use them to the best of your ability. And it's a great story. And how people respond to that is really interesting, because Jesus seems to be saying there are three different kind of groups of people. Verse 14 says, but his subjects hated him and sent a delegation after him to say, we don't want this man to be our king. Could be that that's a resonance with them, something that happened round about that time. In fact, before this time, Herod the Great's son Archelaus went to Augustus Caesar in Rome to ask if he could be made the king. And Archelaus was so hated by Jewish people that 50 senior Jewish people went to Caesar Augustus to say, please don't make him the king. So as people heard this, they might have thought, well, this sounds a bit like that, you know, this historical event that had happened. And so Jesus is quite good at picking up what was happening in the culture and then trying to relate that to the people of the time. And it may well be that that's exactly what was going on here. But basically, verse 14 is the first reaction. Here's the resources that are given, and people rebel and say, no, I'm not going to do that. I'm not going to engage with that. I'm not going to get into that. I'm just not having anything to do with it. People rebel. And it's not unusual. In verse 27, at the end of this section, we kind of given a clue as to what happens if you rebel against the master. Verse 27 says, but those enemies of mine who did not want me to be a king over them, bring them here and kill them in front of me. Which is very shocking to us. Quite a severe word. And many people who would say they're following Christ would find verses like this hard, but it's there, and we have to deal with it. We have to think about, what does this actually mean? How do we interpret that? How do we see that? And I think it means that idea of judgment, you know, if we rebel against God, claiming to be his servants and then saying, no, I'm not going to do what the Lord wants me to do, there will be a judgment. This is a serious, serious matter. And those who claim to follow Jesus, maybe we aren't really following Jesus, we've just got a cultural kind of, this is what we do, yes, I believe in him. There's a difference between believing in him and following him, working that out. What does that look like? So that's the first group. There's a group that might be described as rebels. The rebels ultimately are not going to survive. Shocking. And the first listeners would have been shocked by that. So the first group are the rebels. And then secondly, verses 15 to 19, you get what we might describe as the good ones, the good servants. The good servants. You have the rebels and then you have the good servants. And we read about them in verses 15 to 19. He was made king, however, and returned home. Then he sent for his servants to whom he had given the money in order to find out what they had gained with it. First one came and said, "Sir, your mina has earned 10 more." "Well done, my good servant," his master replied, "because you have been trustworthy in a very small matter, take charge of 10 cities. Second one came and said, "Sir, your mina has earned 5 more." His master answered, "You take charge of 5 cities." Then after that came another servant. We'll come on to that in a minute. So there are the good servants. And again, this reminds us, you know, there are two issues or two problems in the Christian life. There are those who think you can get to heaven by just being a good person. And it's amazing. It is amazing the number of people, even in churches which would claim to be Bible teaching, Bible believing churches, who think that's what the Christian message is. Just if you're good enough, you can somehow earn your way into heaven. And then there are those who think, no, it's just my faith alone. You know, as long as I have faith, doesn't matter what I do, that I'll get to heaven. And, you know, again, I meet people and have met people and regularly meet people who claim that they are followers of Jesus, and yet their behaviour and the way they live that out, there is no sign in the way they live their life that they actually are following Jesus. And so we have this balance to be struck, which is we don't earn our way into heaven by good deeds, but we show our faith by the good deeds that we do. It's the outworking of our relationship with God. And so faith and works go together. The letter to James kind of expresses that beautifully and clearly. We need both those things to be going on. We demonstrate our service, our trust in God, by the way we live our lives. And that's what this parable, it was one of the things this parable is trying to get us to understand at a deep level. That we need to use what we've been given as well as we can. We might not have been given much, but we can use it to the glory of God. We may feel we're not particularly gifted, but whatever we've got, we can use it to the glory of God. We can encourage one another, we can build one another, we can point people in the right direction, we can serve one another in small ways and in large ways. We can give as much as we can from the financial resources that we've been given. We can use our gifts as much as we can in order to invest in the kingdom of God. So the good servants do that. What is a mina? And you know, if we're interpreting this, what might a mina count as? Well, some people say it's the resources that the Holy Spirit gives, the resources of the gifts of the Spirit and the fruit of the Spirit shining forth from our lives. Some people say it's the gospel message itself. That's the thing that we need to invest in, getting it out there, knocking on doors, standing on the street, talking to people, being in the workplace, talking to our family, talking to our friends, and trying to show people the love of Jesus. And still others would say, well, it's about our gifts, our talent, our money. And the reality is, I suspect it is all of these things. The minas that Jesus is referring to here is just everything that is under our kind of view or under our control, and everything that is given to us by God. All of that, the resources that the Lord supplies us with, both spiritual and practical. That's what we have a responsibility to use those as best we can. And notice this, when we use what God has given to us in his service, do you notice what happens at the end of it? Now this has been, I want to be careful about what I say here. But you notice that at the end of it, the master says, you can have 10 cities, you have 5 cities. And it's not the idea, it's not like a feudal arrangement where, you know, you're going to, it's not like health, wealth and prosperity. If you give much, you will be given, you know, great properties to look after. It's not like a medieval king distributing peerages to people and lands and castles and so on. But it's a picture that people would understand. Actually, if you give and you use, you're given huge responsibility. You're being given greater responsibilities. That's the reward. The reward actually would seem to be more service, not less, and more responsibility, because you've been a trusted servant. And that's not to weigh us down. It's not to make us feel, I can't cope with this, I've got more than enough in my life. It's just an indicator of God's love for us and his trust. As we trust in him, he entrusts more to us. I think that's what it's trying to say. As we trust in him, he entrusts more to us. So there's that second group, the good servants, who have, you know, the Bible teaches us about storing up treasures in heaven when we give and when we share. And it's hard to know what the treasures are, what the rewards are going to be in concrete terms. But it's about that idea of a long-term investment, a lasting legacy. It's saying whatever you do now, it counts, it matters. What you do with your life, what you do with the resources that God gives you, they count. They count. The way that you use what God gives you, it matters. It's a real antidote to, you know, the whole problem of work thing, isn't it? I sometimes say the work we're given simply keeps a roof over our head, puts food on the table, allows us to live. You know, it's not our life. We don't necessarily take our identity from our jobs. You know, our culture kind of says that to us when we meet people in a dinner party or something. One of the things we want it to help us understand who people are, we'll ask, you know, what do you do? But given that, you know, we may work 35 or 40 or 50 hours a week, you know, we maybe work a third at most, a third of our weekly hours, you know, the hours that there are in the week are spent working, something like that. And so it's not a life, you know, our work is not a life, and we have a bigger purpose and a bigger vision and a bigger sense of the purpose that God has given to us. Let's just look at a couple of other verses, maybe just to help illustrate this a little bit. If we turn over in the Bible to Matthew chapter 10, for example, in verse 42, this might help illustrate. It says this, and if anyone gives even a cup of cold water to one of these little ones, because he's my disciple, I tell you the truth, he will certainly not lose his reward. So, yeah, a real illustration of how sharing and giving is something that the Lord sees and recognises. There is reward in doing that, in sharing what God has given to us. Or how about we turn over to the letter to the Colossians. This is where, in my Bible, Colossians suddenly decides to disappear, and I have to spend time on this video trying to find Colossians again. But if we turn over to Colossians, we'll get a flavour of this. In Colossians chapter 3 and verses 18 to chapter 4 verse 1, it says this: wives, submit to your husbands as is fitting in the Lord. Towards the end, I mean, this is all important as well, husbands and wives working together, supporting one another, putting one another first, serving one another. That's all really important in this as well. We get a reward as we do. Those of us who are married, that's what we do. We reveal our love for God by doing that. But the key verse I wanted to draw in was verse 23, where it says this: whatever you do, work at it with all your heart as working for the Lord, not for men, since you know that you will receive an inheritance from the Lord as a reward. It's the Lord Christ you are serving. Anyone who does wrong will be repaid for his wrong, and there's no favoritism. Masters, provide your slaves with what is right and fair, because you know that you also have a master in heaven. So again, that's a Paul giving an illustration. Husbands and wives, you need to look after one another, you need to serve one another. There's a reward attached to that, putting one another first. If you're working, do it as if you're doing it for the Lord. He provides for you. And actually speaking into the situation of slavery, where people are downcast and downtrodden perhaps, you know, Paul's saying you need to look after those who are in that condition, in that relationship with you, masters, because you're responsible before God for them. You have a master in heaven, and you will be held accountable for how you care for those who are in your care. That's how the economy worked in those days. It's not, I'm not justifying slavery, and I don't think Paul does that. I think Paul is trying to, the way Jesus, the way Christians dealt with slavery was quite remarkable and quite transformative for the time. They were unable to kind of break slavery as the kind of economic foundation of the Roman Empire, but they insisted that slaves should be treated with decency and with love and with care. And so you would find slave owners and slaves worshipping together in equality. And that must have been really hard at first when that was kind of breaking into the church. But it was that sense of stewardship and caring and having a responsibility for one another, and that the Lord would honour that. The Lord sees it and the Lord honours it. So these are good illustrations, I think, of how in the New Testament we see these principles that Jesus is giving in the parable being worked out. Even the slaves were going to be given dignity for what they did. The slavery was not the same as the slavery that we see in the 17th and 18th and 19th century, particularly in North America, where people were treated very, very badly. It was a very different kind of beast, but nonetheless it could still be degrading. And even the slaves were to be treated well, and masters had to treat slaves well. I'm reminded of, I mean, dignity should be something that we seek to give to all people. And there's a great story of the TV interviewer who sees three workmen working outside a new building that's going up, and he goes over and asks the three workmen, "What is it that you're doing?" And the first person in the interview says, "Oh, I'm breaking up the rock. I'm breaking rocks. It's hard work." And the second person says, "Well, I'm working so that I can feed my kids and put a roof over my family's heads." And the third person says, "And you know what I'm doing here is I'm building a cathedral." And all three of those perspectives are right, but for the first one it's just the drudgery of breaking rocks, the second one it's providing, but the third one is saying, actually I'm doing something that ultimately is going to be beautiful and to the glory of God. Perspective's important in what we do, and we need to have that perspective that we might be true, we're simply doing a hard job, physical job, mental job, and that might be true. We work in order to provide for our families, but we can also be building something that is beautiful and to the glory of God, whatever we're doing. That's why the Colossian passage is quite important, I think. Whatever we do it to the glory of God. So there's a third response as well. We have the rebels, we have the good servants, but we also have a third response, which we get in chapter 19. So please turn to that, back to the Luke passage with me. And we get that in verses 20 to 22. The third response that is possible is found there. So we find these words. Then another servant came and said, "Sir, here is your mina. I've kept it laid away in a piece of cloth. I was afraid of you because you're a hard man. You take out what you did not put in and reap what you did not sow." And his master replied, "I will judge you by your own words, you wicked servant. You knew, did you, that I am a hard man, taking out what I did not put in and reaping what I did not sow. Why then didn't you put my money on deposit so that when I came back I could have collected it with interest?" So there's the third group of people that are shown here. It seems a little bit unfair, doesn't it? This guy's tried to preserve what the master had given to him, to look after it, but effectively did nothing, just sat on what had been given to him. And so he reacts angrily. Maybe it's because he feels like he's a bit of a slave. Maybe he felt that he could have had more responsibility, could have taken more than the minister was offered to him and done more with it. But essentially he's not trusting in the master. He's not trusting in the generosity and the kindness of the master. He's kind of playing safe to not do something that is maybe going to take risks. And he does it, he says here, he does it because he's supposedly in fear of the master. You're a hard man, he says. But actually, I wonder if he really fears the master. I wonder if that's really what's going on here. Maybe he doesn't fear the master enough. Maybe that's really what's happening, because he doesn't understand his responsibilities. It's kind of interesting, isn't it, that he says, when the master says, why then didn't you put my money on deposit so that when I came back I could have collected it with interest? And of course, you weren't allowed to do that. If you were a Jewish person, you weren't allowed to go to the bank, or usually getting interest on loans was unacceptable in Jewish culture. So it's a kind of unusual picture, and people have struggled to kind of interpret what this is about. Some people have said it's the go to the Pharisees or go to the Gentiles, and maybe that's what it's about. It's about a bigger picture. You need to have a bigger picture and not just think about what is easy and what is going to cost you minimum. It's kind of Jesus is saying that you need to be creative here. And you need to think, you know, how can I invest what the Lord has given to me creatively so that others might hear about the gospel? That seems to be what the picture is that Jesus is offering here, that God's people are called to be creative and to be prepared to take risks. And that's hard for a lot of us. That's really hard. It's hard for us to think outside the box. It's hard for us to do that. We're going to be doing the Easter visitation around the local area. We've got cards to give out. We came across this brilliant picture, and it's a picture of an Easter egg in a box. Beside it says, maybe it's time to think outside the box. I just loved it when I saw this, because it tied in with this idea of trying to give Easter eggs to people. But if we're inviting people outside the kingdom, outside the church, to think outside the box this Easter, how much more do we need to do that constantly? Think outside the box about what church is and how we function and what we're about and how we meet and how we gather and what our structures are. You know, we need to be asking that question. What is going to be the most effective way for us to reach out with the love of God, with the gospel, the good news of Jesus? What might we do that is different? What might we build on that we already do that is good, that God could use all the more? But the key issue, I think, is how we invest. I love that story, the two wee boys talking, and one wee boy says to the other, Jimmy, if you had £1 million, would you give me half of it? And Jimmy says, you know, Johnny, I would give you half of it. And then Johnny says, Jimmy, if you had £1,000, would you give me a half of it? And Johnny says, Jimmy, if I had £1,000, I would give you half of it. And then Johnny says, Jimmy, if you had 100 marbles, would you give me 50 of your marbles? And Johnny says, I would give you 50 of my marbles. And then Johnny says to Jimmy, if you had 2 marbles, would you give me one of them? And Jimmy turns around and says, Johnny, you know I've got 2 marbles. And that's, I think that's what this parable is actually all about. Are we willing to give our all? Are we willing to risk our all for the sake of Jesus? Are we willing to surrender what we have, who we are, what we think for him, and put him first and give up everything for him? It's a huge challenge. There's no way around it. There's no way one can escape it. But that's what we're called to be about. So tonight, I hope you... I found this challenging, really, to read this and to think about it a little bit. And I hope you're challenged by it too. And may it be something that is on our hearts, the Lord lays on our hearts as a church. Will we give our all in our service of Jesus? Amen. May God bless you. I hope you have a good time praying together. Thanks to Miller and Margaret, who I think are going to be leading tonight, and we'll be remembering you in our prayers this evening. Thanks for listening.